Welcome to the Union Jews Podcast. The UK's only all things union show. Carefully curated for your digital downloadable listening pleasure. Hello, 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 and welcome to a brand new series of Union Jews, the UK's only All Things Union podcast. I'm Simon Sapper, and in this episode, our special guest is one of the United States' most influential and important union podcasters, Chris Scarlock. Not content with building a network of 200 union-friendly radio shows and podcasts, Chris also produces and hosts a number of his own, ranging from two-minute daily labour news bites to interview-based heritage shows focusing on film, music and the art, truly an embodiment of the bread and roses concept. But where did the inspiration for all this come from? And once you've got the idea, how on earth did Chris put all this into practice? And while we're talking, is there anyone better placed to give us an overview of what's happening in the US labour movement right now? If for no other reason than the response to a US president turning up with a bullhorn to a union picket line, you'll want to stick around for my chat with Chris a little later in the show. First, though, it is my absolute pleasure to welcome back to Union Jews Glasgow University's Professor of Work and Employment, Melanie Sims, and her Thought for the Week. This week, Mel reflects on the speed of communication facilitated by social media and the challenges that brings to resolving collective conflict.
Welcome back to Union Jews. Since we last spoke, the UK has experienced a wave of industrial action that we haven't seen in my adult lifetime. So there's plenty to reflect on over the coming weeks. Over the summer, I've been very privileged to have interviewed a range of industrial relations specialists, academics, union officers, employers, various lawyers, etc., about the ways that strike action has been changing in recent years. And one of the issues that kept coming up in those discussions was around communications and how comms have changed, what that means for building collectivism, taking strike action, and eventually resolving disputes. So there's a lot to say in this area, and I may well come back to this theme in later contributions. But lots of people reflected both on the benefits that new forms of media give to unions, as well as the challenges. And the benefits are pretty clear. Newer media platforms of all kind, both public and private, often give spaces for workers and members to access information about unions, talk about disputes, build networks with each other, understand communications that are coming from central office, and discuss the nature of the dispute with their colleagues and with other members. But also not just in public. And one of the things that came up a lot was about the role of WhatsApp as being a really powerful tool for workers to talk to each other, especially where those networks already exist. So we've seen disputes in a number of occupations where workers already organise themselves, for example, to swap shifts between members of a work group. And those pre-existing messaging groups can be really important organising spaces. And of course, what's fundamentally different about these new media as compared to previous iterations is the speed. And speed matters. Cascading messages via social media or WhatsApp takes just a few moments, but can really help build momentum in a dispute or in an organising campaign. But that speed also brings challenges. These more informal communications routes can mean that union comms are not as clearly crafted to capture points of nuance or specificity and can sometimes challenge some of the confidentiality, particularly in negotiating resolution to collective disputes. These newer communication channels can create the expectation that members are constantly kept up to date at every moment of every turn in negotiations. And that creates dynamics where formal dispute resolution is being negotiated. Those negotiation processes often take weeks or months across many, many meetings. And one of the things I think we're all learning from this round of disputes is there really is a job for union comms teams to work out how to take advantage of the appetite for information at speed, whilst also balancing the need for confidentiality and the complexity of collective negotiations. It's becoming clear that the speed of comms in contemporary disputes brings both new challenges and new opportunities for unions, for their activists, and for their members. So starting conversation about what we're all learning seems to me to be a really important opportunity. And this episode seems to be a really useful starting point for that conversation.
Thanks very much indeed, Mel. It's really good to have you back. Now, when Chris Garlock told me he was taking a walking tour the whole length of the Thames, he asked if I could put together a ramble around some significant union sites associated with the river. As a born and bred Londoner and a dyed-in-the-wool trade unionist, I thought, this can't be so hard. But I was embarrassed to have to admit it wasn't straightforward. I mean, you know, let's think about this. Of course, there's Congress House itself, but I was a bit stumped otherwise. The docks are all gone. Caroon House, where the Labour Party was founded, has been demolished and redeveloped numerous times. The Wapping Printworks is now about to be relaunched as a music and dance venue, and the TVAM building is derelict apart from the egg cups on the roof. Not even the ghosts of historic workers' struggles remain. So I was particularly grateful to the Match Girls Memorial Trust and the Society for the Study of Labour History for, in some cases, pointing out the obvious things that I'd missed, and in others, signposting otherwise hidden gems. In particular, a huge shout out to Quinton Outram and Mark Crail of the Society and Sam Johnson of the Trust for their help. If you want to find out more about either organisation or the tour Chris, his wife Lisa and I went on, visit the companion blog to this podcast over on the Makes You Think website. That's makes-you-think.com. So, it was fresh off the back of these walking endeavours that I sat down with Chris in a quiet corner of a riverside pub to quiz him on podcasting, solidarity, and the state of the American labour movement. Chris, welcome to the Union Juice podcast. Great. Lovely to see you in person.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
For our listeners who aren't familiar with the Labour Radio Podcast Network, could you perhaps describe what it is?
I just wanted to ask, first of all, do you record all of your podcasts in a pub? Because I think that's a great idea.
Oh, well, whenever I can.
I'm sorry. So the question is about the...
The Labour Radio Podcast Network. If our listeners aren't familiar with it, how would you describe it?
So to call it a network might be a little hopeful. It's really just a sort of confederation of over 200 folks like you and like me who are hosting and producing labor radio shows, labor podcasts, most of them in the United States, but we have some in the UK, we have some in Australia, some in Canada, probably one or two other places that I'm forgetting.
The US has a particularly strong community radio culture, unlike the UK, I think. What's the split between radio shows and podcasts?
I'll have to double check that, but my sense at this point, it was at the beginning it was dominated by those of us who have radio shows, but the podcast section has really grown, and I'd say it's probably maybe 60-40, maybe even 70-30 podcast to radio at this point would be just off the top of my head.
But I mean, the reach and range is incredible. That's what I always think whenever I look at what's on the portal, because it's constantly changing and expanding. Of course, the geographic range, the range of subjects, you know, the perspectives, the plurality of voices, if you like, is, I mean, it's deeply impressive.
I have to say it's really exciting. It started really, really simply. I'd been doing a labor radio show in Washington for a while, and then I started to get into podcasting, and I thought, you know, there's other people out here doing this, and I think I was probably doing something like looking for a particular guest or something like that. And so this was probably 4 years ago, and my original idea actually was to sort of organize like a conference call. That was a thing to, you know, to get people all on a conference call. And then it really took off during the pandemic because, you know, we started getting together weekly on Zoom. And there was a real hunger. A lot of us, you know, who do radio shows or podcasts, it can be a bit of a silo.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you're interviewing, but then you're producing and you're getting it out there. And so this visibility on a weekly basis to meet other folks who are doing the same sort of thing. And some of it can be, you know, quite ordinary. You know, what kind of microphone do you like? You know, boom, what can we, what's a good boom? What's a bad boom? Oh, I'm looking for a guest on a certain topic. And so it can really be helpful with just some real sort of ordinary nuts and bolts things.
And how did you get the idea for the network to start with?
Really, you know, solidarity. Yeah. You know, solidarity, the idea that there are other folks out there doing what I'm doing, and it meeting up with you, getting to chat with you, getting a tour of London, a labor tour of London, which doesn't exist, but it did because of our connection.
That's for sure.
And so I think I'd say it's a basic idea of labor, solidarity.
But the Labor Radio Podcast Network is not the only thing you do, is it?
Oh, goodness, no. No, I have several radio shows that I do. I do a drive time 2-minute one called the Labor Radio Podcast Daily, which there's a weekly podcast version of that where we take excerpts from anywhere around maybe a half a dozen shows that are in the network. Maybe 3, 4, 5 minutes from each show, pull them out. And it's a chance for folks to give a listen and say, you know, oh, this sounds like a show I'd like to subscribe to. And so then the daily is just, we'll take, say, for example, we had featured your show in the weekly. We'd have probably 5 or 6 minutes of the show in the weekly. But in the daily, we would take just like 30 seconds. And again, it's a chance for folks to get a taste for the different shows.
Yeah.
So there's that. I have my own weekly show, and the Labor Radio Podcast Daily is on a station in Washington, D.C., WPFW. It's part of the Pacifica Network, which I believe has 8 stations around the country. And then my weekly show on WPFW is the Labor Heritage Power Hour, and that focuses on labor arts. Could be music, could be film, could be theater. And that's really kind of an interview show, where we try and feature labor arts. And in the States, we have a saying about, actually, no, this is an international thing. It's bread and roses.
Yes, we
have our bread, but we need our roses too.
Absolutely.
So that's what the Labor Heritage Power Hour is about. And then my sort of personal baby is the Labor Heritage, or the Labor History Today podcast, which is a weekly, comes out on Sundays. I started that probably 5 years ago. My dad's a labor historian. When he would come down to Washington, we would just sort of go around doing a lot like you and I did in you know, London today, sort of looking for labor history.
That's quite an impressive range. Do you find time to sleep ever? How did you sort of get into sort of podcasting and radio work to start with? What's your kind of trade union journey, as it were?
I give you the long, boring answer, or the short? I give you the short, sexy one.
give me the long, exciting answer.
Oh, tough one. No, I was trained as a journalist, a print journalist, and sort of radio and podcasting is a natural outgrowth of journalism. You know, I like quick turnaround. I like to have as few steps between me. Like, I don't think, you know, I organize a labor film festival. I love labor films. People say, oh, you should make a film. Films take years to make, yes. You know? I have no patience for that. I have, you know, utmost respect for people that can spend, you know, 3, 4, 5 years making a film. I'm not that kind of person. It's why I like journalism. You know, I write it and it gets edited and it gets published, and yeah, and then yeah, then it's the bottom of the birdcage. That's okay. It's the same reason that I love radio and podcasts. Radio was kind of cool because radio, you do radio, it goes out in the air and then it's gone. Podcasts are cool because they're like radio in terms of you just sort of throw them out in the air, but they live on.
Yeah.
We were talking about earlier, where one of the cool things about podcasts is that I'll put out a podcast and I give a certain number of people who listen to it right away. But, you know, people listen to it a month later or 2 months later. It lives on.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a very immediate. And I think the other reason that I really got into and really appreciate radio and podcasting, it's a very intimate format. You know, people listening to this are probably working out, like I know you like to do when you're listening to podcasts, or walking, like I need to do, like to do, or maybe driving or cooking, or but you're usually doing something else. There are very few people that are just going to sit around and think, I think I'll sit down and listen to a podcast or a radio show. And I kind of like that. It keeps me on my toes because I'm not guaranteed your attention, am I?
Yeah, for sure. So have you known from a young age that communications was the area that you wanted to work in? And at what point did that kind of become more refined to union communications?
I did. When I was very young, probably 12 or something, I think maybe it was my grandparents for Christmas gave me a little printing press, a little rubber letters, and you could put together and make a little like a little mimeograph machine. And I was just fascinated by the process of putting that together and then, you know, running it off, and did the little newsletter. And so, you know, my email newsletters are just sort of the modern version of that. But again, I liked the immediacy, and I've always liked storytelling from a very early age. I still like storytelling. And so these are, you know, whether I was doing journalism or websites or email newsletters, all of which I still do, or radio or podcasts, these are all communication tools. There are so many. I haven't gotten into TikTok. It may be beyond me. I think I may have reached my limit. But there's lots of 12-year-olds who can do it very well.
So the union stuff, though, how did you become enmeshed in this world?
So as I mentioned, my father was a labor historian, so I was very exposed to labor history growing up. And then when I moved back to Rochester in my mid-20s, I got a job working with the local labor council, which would be like the TUC here, I think. And so I really loved it. I got to work with all the different unions in town, auto workers, teachers, industrial, construction. And so it was a really good, I'd known labor history, and now I got to actually work in the labor movement with what was going on. And I found that I spent a lot of time in my early career doing communications, working in newspapers, and then I did time working in the labor movement. And so I sort of found my way to doing labor communications. And so that sort of mixed all of the things in my world together.
Cool. Gosh, if you look across the range of podcasts that you do and that you listen to and apart from the network, how would you describe the health of the US labor organizations at the moment?
You know, it's fascinating. Sort of counterintuitively, the labor movement in the US is just doing incredibly well right now. It's become hip. For one thing, which is, you could accuse labor movement of a lot of things, but being hip was really.
But it's such a vital, if rare, commodity to be hip. That's what you want.
It's crazy. It has absolutely been just phenomenal to see. It really started with things like the teachers' strikes about 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. Who, by the way, wore red neckerchiefs because they were they're in West Virginia, and they were very aware of the history of miners wearing red neckerchiefs. Yeah. So these were teachers and who were also, this was not a sanctioned strike. This was a complete wildcat strike. And so the movement has really been invigorated by a lot of younger members doing things. You know, the Starbucks workers are not organizing in any of the traditional ways. Any experienced labor organizer will tell you they are organizing in completely the wrong way. And yet, there they are. And, you know, the big strikes that we've had this year with the screenwriters and then the actors. I mean, the actors hadn't been on strike in several generations. Screenwriters have struck more frequently. but these are you know, groups of people who are, you know, not what you would consider the auto workers of the 30s, right, in terms of militants. And yet the militants of the screenwriters on the picket line was phenomenal. I interviewed a number of actors, young actors and more experienced actors, who, again, you wouldn't necessarily think of that, you know, those kind of union members as the most radical, and yet they completely understand what they're fighting for, not just their own local fights, but that they are, you know, in these fights about AI, for example. They understand that, yes, the screenwriters have their specific issues about AI, but they are the canary in the coal mine in terms of this is a whole change that's happening to us all. Everybody. And so they're very aware of their role. Same thing with the actors. The auto workers are also fighting automation. This is very interesting because my labor history podcast, which is supposed to be about history, only history is very much alive now. And so it's fascinating to see people like screenwriters and actors and auto workers striking about, you know, AI is very modern and yet automation is the old as the hills. Yeah. So thinking about your textile workers here, what, 500 years ago, same thing.
Yeah. A number of unions now have got new leaders, general secretaries, as we call them in the UK, who have come from not the traditional path, not the traditional pool. I mean, is that impression correct? And secondly, if it is, what does that mean?
We've had a lot of that in the US. There's been a new generation of leaders coming in, for one thing, but there are also upsets. There's been not just a new generation, which would be the normal turnover in a union, but there's also been people coming in who have been challenging the sort of the established union leadership. And so a lot of that is definitely going on. And the workforces have been changing. There's younger members, there are, you know, digital natives, there are folks who expect more from their unions than just fighting about, you know, wages and hours, for example. Yeah. And so it was very interesting in the actor strike, which of course is still going on, where you had members of the union who were telling their negotiating committee, yeah, don't settle. Yeah. We don't want you to just settle. We don't want to just get a deal. These are the things that we want. So there's a real militance that is coming, I think, from the grassroots, but it's also coming. You listen to the new leader of the auto workers, and auto workers have been through some real problems with the corrupt leadership. But, you know, their new leadership, I mean, you could take him and put him in the 1930s, he'd fit right in. So yeah, I think there's a lot more militance, and I mean, frankly, it's needed. It's needed.
That kind of leads into the next question, which is, yeah, there are challenges, of course, but it must be good to see the president of the United States on a union picket line. That hasn't happened before, I don't think.
No, we've never. We've at best, what, you know, we would get, you know, a president like, you know, Obama said some nice things about union. We were very excited about that. But no, we have never seen a president actually not only go on the picket line, but be fairly militant in terms of saying you deserve a good contract. It was just nuts. You know, that the president of the United States would show up not only on a picket line, but wielding a bullhorn, which is a classic image for us, you know, on a picket line, right? I know union leaders who I've never seen with a bullhorn. I've known union leaders I've never seen on a picket line, right? So to see the president on a picket line with a bullhorn saying you deserve, you know, a 40% raise. The big thing we talk about in the U.S. is about how, you know, when Reagan fired the air traffic controllers, it was like Thatcher and the coal miners, right? It wasn't just about Thatcher and the coal miners or Reagan and the traffic controllers. These are messages that go out across the country to every working person, to every union member, says you got a target on your back. You know, there's a change, right? This is like that in a good way. When you have the president on a picket line with a bullhorn saying, I'm with you, it changes things. So whatever happens with that strike, which I'm sure they will win it, but it's much more important in terms of what it says to other people, people who are in a union who want more, people who are not in a union who may want a union. So yeah, it's critical.
Yeah. Well, I mean, no doubt we will continue this discussion but virtually, and we'll hear the latest developments on new union leadership, the attitude of the president, the mood music in the country on one of your many podcasts.
Oh, I'm sure. You can find them all on the Liber Radio Podcast Network, which your podcasts are both members of.
Absolutely. And I can't thank you enough for the support that you and the network have given Union Days and Union Dues as well. So as I say, it's been great to meet you and talk to you, and best of luck.
Thanks so much for having me.
Cheers. Well, my thanks to Chris for some fascinating insights. And if you want to access the network, then visit Labour Radio Network, all one word, and Labour spelt without a U, labourradionetwork.org. Full details, background and signposting, as ever, in the companion blog to this episode, which I know you know is over on the Makes You Think website. So that's about it for now. My thanks again to Mel and to Chris, and above all, to you for your company over the last half hour or so. You can contact the show by email at unionjews@makesyouthink.com, and you can find us on X at Jews Union. Although the way Musk is running the show, I don't honestly know how much longer we'll stay. Be that as it may, please do like, share, and review and rate. It really is appreciated. You can access all episodes of the show from your preferred podcast platform. And if you subscribe, then each episode will be delivered to you and you won't miss a thing. You can also, of course, access the show through the Labour Radio Podcast Network portal. And if you like what you've heard, then check out our sister show, Union Days, shortlisted in the 2023 Independent Podcast Awards and also available from your preferred podcast platform. We'll be back in a couple of weeks when our special guest will be the redoubtable and deservedly revered industrial correspondent Alan Jones, looking both backwards and forwards on the relationship between unions, journalists, and the media. Don't miss it. Until then, solidarity with all those fighting to defend and improve their working lives. Let's take good care of each other, and I'll see you in the next episode of Union Jews. Bye for now. You've been listening to the Union Jews podcast, presented by me, Simon Sapper, music by Scott Holmes, a Makes You Think production.